Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on this first day of October 2025. It is a Wednesday, 16 minutes past the hour, and you are not going to want to leave your radio or listening device in the next hour, because we are going to talk about a book which is number one. It's the number one wrestling book right now on Amazon.com. This book is about one of my favorite people in the history of professional wrestling, certainly from the era when I was watching professional wrestling. The book is entitled Irresistible Force, The Life and Times of Gorilla Monsoon. The author is Brian R. Solomon, and this book is forwarded by Brett the Hitman Hart. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones author Brian R. Solomon. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing okay, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
You know, Brian, this book is quite an accomplishment, written about a man who has been gone for over 25 years now. Why this book?
Well, you know, I realized quickly that Gorilla Monsoon was somebody who, first of all, had never had a book done about him. There'd never been a documentary or anything like that. And how important he was to the history of WWE, which is, you know, the biggest, most important wrestling company in the whole industry and has been for a long time. And he was a crucial part of that. And I don't know if enough people really understood that. Maybe they just remembered him as that friendly announcer, which he was great at, but he was so much more. So this book is intended to really get all of that across.
Why do you believe right now this is the number one wrestling book on Amazon.com? What is it about this book? And I've seen more people and heard more people talking about it in wrestling circles than any book in a long time.
Well, I've been working very hard to promote it. I think that's part of it. I've been working on it for 3 years, and I've been kind of giving these teases all that time about everything that was going to be in it and what I was doing and why I was doing it, and people started to get very intrigued. But it also comes down to the fact that Gorilla Monsoon is so universally recognizable and so universally beloved. And it's funny, even for younger fans that may not remember him when he was active, they know of him because he's included in his voice, you know, is included in all the WWE history packages and documentaries and clips and things, doing commentary. So they know that voice and they know what the gorilla position is. So he's a fascinating character, I think, to fans of all ages.
Gorilla's been gone since October the 6th, 1999, so he's been gone quite a while. How hard was it to do the research for this book?
You know what? It's always a challenge to do this kind of research. But as you may know, especially being in the Ohio area, my last book, Blood and Fire, was the life story of the original Sheik. And that was actually a lot more difficult because he was so mysterious and private and never gave public interviews. And a lot of people didn't want to talk about him because they didn't want to break the illusion. And that was really tough. This one, the biggest challenge was that there was such an abundance of information and an abundance of interviews. I mean, he actually had his own newspaper column in the Philadelphia Journal for years. So I have his direct words and things like that. So the challenge was kind of weeding out figuring out what was going to make it into the book and what shape it was going to take to have sort of a cohesive structure, so it's not just a collection of facts or some kind of a timeline. So that was the biggest struggle with this book.
For people who might not have heard the name Gorilla Monsoon or who might not be familiar with him, wrestling fans of the current time, if you had to describe this man over his long and varied career, how would you describe him?
Well, he was someone who had several different phases in his career. You know, he was a standout amateur wrestler as a young man. He was almost in the Olympics, and he wrestled, you know, in the NCAA finals, and he got the attention of wrestling promoters. Now, the first phase of his career was he was a main event heel. He was a top wrestling bad guy, and he was a major attraction in the 1960s because he was so large, and, you know, he had this great character where he was this mute monster. But later on, he morphed into something more than that because he wound up buying part ownership of the company, which at the time was known as the WWWF. And he wound up owning a portion of it, and he had that until Vince McMahon took over the company in the 80s, and then he was bought out, and then he entered the next phase of his career, which was the announcing phase, where, as a lot of people remember, when the WWF went national, he was kind of the voice and the face of it, you know, and Vince himself as well, but he did so much of the commentary, and he was always there, a part of the TV show. He later was named the WWF president. He was a Hall of Famer, and he was just very beloved within that company and an integral part. And the other thing, actually, before I don't want to fail to mention it, after he bought into the company, he took on a very crucial role backstage, which today we would kind of call TV producer. You know, he was there at the ready, behind the curtain, running the show, making sure everyone had their instructions and everything was timed perfectly. That was his responsibility. So, I mean, he was absolutely crucial to this company for many years.
Why was this man, who was obviously a very intelligent man, a very educated man, how did he end up in the world of professional wrestling?
Yes, he was educated, college educated, and not only that, but Dean's List, you know, very high performing academically. And I think that helped him a lot in the business because not a lot of guys were. And he really had his head on his shoulders. I think what it comes down to is the money. I mean, the amount of money you could make, because he had been a school teacher briefly before that. That was his original goal. He was a teacher. He was a coach at a local high school in Rochester, New York, where he lived. And but he was also massive and very athletically gifted. So as I said, like, this put him on the radar of wrestling promoters, and when he found out how much money you could make, you know, he actually said, there's a story in the book about how the Toronto promoter, Frank Tunney, reached out to him and said, I want you to consider this, you know, I know you're a school teacher, but we're willing to pay you $500 a week, and this is 1960, and he said, you know, think about it and contact me on Monday, and Gino or Gorilla just said, I'll be there tomorrow, you know, he didn't even need time to make the decision. And then he actually said later, if I could have made the same money teaching school, I would have preferred to stay teaching school. You know, he really loved applying his education in that way, but the money was just too much to pass up, and he was in a very unique position to make that kind of money because he was so athletically gifted and so physically imposing, especially for those days. You know, he was 6'6" and about 375 pounds in the beginning. He got bigger, and so, you know, he took advantage of that.
When he was wrestling, how popular was he around the country?
The thing is, as a lot of people may know, in those days, wrestling was very regional. And it was territorial. There was no national wrestling promotion. So depending where you lived in the country, you would see a different brand of wrestling, a different wrestling company would be presenting wrestling to you. So the thing about Gorilla during his career is, other than the first couple of years where he was traveling, once he settled into the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, which in those days was based in the northeastern United States, he basically stayed there. So he had wrestled in the first 3 years of his career. He wrestled up in Canada. He went out to California, Hawaii, some places in St. Louis and Kansas City. You know, he was getting around, but he wasn't really a big star yet. He became a big star in the Northeast. And so essentially, fans in other parts of the country didn't get to see a whole lot of him as a wrestler. And that's probably why he isn't as well remembered as a wrestler, but I will tell you this. In the Northeast, he absolutely is. I'm from New York, and our wrestling territory was always the WWF, even before Vince McMahon Jr. took over. So, and not to mention the fact that because all the wrestling magazines were based in New York in those days, his name and his face and his legend was spread to other places through the magazines. Like, he would be on covers, he would be well covered inside. So fans had an awareness of him as a major star, but he just wasn't seen live in a lot of places outside of the Northeastern United States.
He's a headline wrestler in the Northeast. How does he get involved in the ownership of the company?
And, well, believe it or not, that happened when he was 32 years old, and he was made not only a 25% owner, but the vice president. And that happened because, you know, the company, as a lot of people may know, was founded by Vince McMahon's father, Vince McMahon Sr., in the late 50s. And Vince McMahon Sr. had a business partner named Joe Toots Mont, who was a real old-time, grizzled old wrestling veteran and promoter. And they were 50-50, so Toots owned 50%. Toots was also an old man. And by the end of the 60s, he was looking to get out, and he wanted to sell his 50% share. And so it went through this whole twisted course. They were originally going to sell it to Bruno Sammartino, who was their top star, to kind of keep him close and keep him loyal. Bruno wasn't interested. And what they decided to do was split up the shares, the 50%, and they gave 25% to a promoter named Phil Zacco, who was very loyal, and he became the treasurer. And they gave the other 25% to Gino, to Gorilla. And part of that was he was loyal, he was intelligent, he was very well respected. He also could take care of himself physically. He was somebody that nobody was going to mess with. He was really smart about the business and about TV production. He was young and vital. And he wasn't going to go anywhere. He was settled. He had a home in New Jersey. He was raising a family. He was not looking to leave and go traveling the territories. He was happy to stay there as long as they wanted him there. So he really seemed like the perfect guy. And actually, what a lot of people don't know, and I've confirmed it several times, is he was originally earmarked to take over the company when Vince McMahon Sr. was going to retire or didn't want to do it anymore. And so this, you know, Vince McMahon's son coming into the picture was not the original plan.
Well, and that's a very interesting chapter in this book, when Vince McMahon's son, Vince McMahon Jr., the man we all know as Vince McMahon now, comes into the picture. Gorilla owns 25% of the company. He's a big name in that area as a wrestler and doing other things. He's earmarked to take over the company. Why doesn't that happen?
Well, he wasn't happy that it didn't happen, first of all. So Vince McMahon Sr. was really getting tired. He was getting sick. He had pancreatic cancer. I don't know if he knew yet that he had it, but he was definitely suffering the effects. And so about 1981, 82, he was looking to get out. He was looking to sell his 50%. And he couldn't find a buyer because it was no one had the money to put up. It was expensive, you know, the asking price. And his idea then, Vince Sr., was he was going to sell his 50% to the other partners. And so, and there was a third partner by that point, Arnold Skoland, who had been cut in for 10%. And if he had done that, that would have been the point where Gorilla would have taken over, because Phil Zacco was very old and looking to retire. Arnold Skoland was a junior partner, and Gorilla would have been the main partner, and that would have been the moment. And at that moment, Vince Jr., who'd been working for the company already by that point for 12, 13 years, and, you know, he got wind of this, and he swooped in and said, no, don't do that, don't do that. I want to buy in. And he talked to his dad. He got his dad on board first, and he bought his dad. Well, you know, his dad said, okay, I'll sell you my 50%. And that's where Vince, the younger Vince, said, no, that's not what I want. I want all of it. I don't just want your shares. I want everybody's shares. And that became a point of contention because they had to convince these guys to do this. And it could have gone south really easily. It was not a smooth transition. It was a lot rockier than people think.
Why would Gorilla decide eventually to sell his 25%?
I think, well, The idea is they had to make him the kind of deal that he wanted, and he really got anything he wanted because out of all the partners, he had the most to lose, and he knew it. And you got to keep in mind, there was no guarantee this was even going to work. It could have been a disaster. They could have lost everything. So at a certain point, he was very much against it, very disillusioned, very angry. A lot of people who knew him at the time knew this. But I think he realized, you know, what were his options? If he had chosen to oppose it, it could have gone to court. It could have gone into litigation. There was legal recourse that the McMahons could have taken. They could have dissolved the company and restructured a new company and left the partners completely out in the cold. They could have been tied up in legal battles for years. And Gorilla, I think, quickly realized it was a battle that he couldn't win. And he kind of thought, well, what else am I going to do? Am I going to just go back to being a school teacher? You know, my lifestyle and everything. Wrestling is my life. And so he knew he had some leverage, though. He knew they weren't going to do it without his approval. It was going to be very difficult. So he got just the sweetheart deal. And I think that's what finally made him happy when he saw that it was going to be very lucrative. You know, his deal was he wanted to always be on television, so that's how he became the announcer. He wanted to be a crucial part of the television product, and he wanted a job for life, which he also got. And he wanted, this was the key part, his deal called for 1.5 times opening match money. So like the amount of money that an opening match wrestler would make plus 50% for every single show that the WWF put on anywhere, whether he was there or not. So this became a major cash cow for him. He was, you know, making the best money, ironically, of his career, even more money than he was making when he was a partner. Because the company did so well. Now, it wasn't anywhere near the kind of money he would have made if he was allowed to hold on to his shares. But, you know, he just knew that wasn't going to happen. If Vince McMahon Jr. had allowed the partners to hold on to their shares while he had the 50%, they would have all been multimillionaires and today billionaires. But, you know, they got cut out of that. So Gorilla had a very nice lifestyle, but certainly not as wealthy as he could have been if things had gone a little differently.
I think two of the obvious questions that come out of that, could Gorilla have gone to his friend and business partner for so many years, Vince Sr., and said, you know, listen, I would prefer that you don't do this. Maybe sell it to me, sell it amongst the partners. I don't think your kid's ready. Or would there have been a way where Vince Jr. would have let Gorilla keep his 25% while getting 75% of the company?
I wish that there's a way that we could know that much of the intricate details of the doings. You know, the only people that know that today would be Vince and Linda McMahon because they were directly involved in the deal-making. And I don't know if they're going to go into detail anytime soon. Now, there's probably paperwork about it somewhere, but it's locked up in a WWE vault. So a lot of it you kind of have to infer. There was an interview that was given years ago by Jim Troy, who was Vince's right-hand man, in a great wrestling book by Brad Peluchian called The Six Pack. And he talked about, being a party to that meeting, and he gave actual number amounts, dollar amounts of what was paid out and everything. But even he wouldn't have known that level of kind of inner circle dealings. But I think the key element was Vince got his father on board. And look, this is father and son. He went to his father and he got him on board with it. And Vince Sr. was simply not going to turn against his son and take the side of these other people. Even if Vince Sr. had his own doubts, which he did, and his own concerns if it was going to work, in the end he chose the loyalty to his family. He chose, in fact, he gave Vince, his son, the kind of a deal that other potential buyers wouldn't have had. So the cost of buying all of the shares was $1.7 million, which even in 1982 was a very low ball figure for the most lucrative wrestling company in America. And other buyers wouldn't have had such a great price. He also got a structured deal where he would have to pay in 12 monthly installments. There was a 30-day grace period at the end. I mean, it was very cushy. And in fact, the McMahons even later admitted that a lot of the payments they were making, and try to wrap your head around this, were actually coming from the company's own profits. So they were paying the partners with the company's own money, which makes no sense, certainly. And even, you know, they admitted this recently in the Netflix documentary on Vince McMahon, and that's certainly a privilege that no other potential buyer would have been allowed. Mm. So it just, to me, it just shows the loyalty that Vince had to his son, that the, you know, that was blood, and that's what he was going to choose over his business partners.
In the early 80s, when this is all going on, Vince McMahon Jr. is seen as an announcer on television. Gorilla becomes an announcer. This is just the start of the rock and wrestling connection. How does Vince McMahon Jr., how do he and Gorilla get along at that point?
I think by that point, things were getting better. So, you know, they're not that far apart. They're only 8 years apart, so it wasn't really like a father-son type of thing. It was more, originally, they were really rivals in those, especially back in the 70s. You know, Vince was the boss's son, and Gorilla was the guy who was running the show. So there was conflict there. There was friction. And I think originally they really held each other at arm's length. When they were working together on that level in the 80s, and there was all that trust that you needed to have in order to make it work, I think that's the point where they grew to respect each other. They grew to be friends. Now, I know from the Gorilla side of things, from talking to his family and people close to him, that he always kind of kept Vince at arm's length to a degree. You know, especially after everything that happened, he worked with him, you know, he liked him, they got along, they trusted each other, they were colleagues, but there was always that sense of kind of, like, you know, I'm going to hold my tongue about a lot of this, and I'm not going to say how I really feel. And I have to imagine that some of that might have also been on the Vince side as well, although I wouldn't have access to that. The only difference being that Vince would have been a lot less disgruntled because he won. He won in that conflict. So, but still, I don't think, like, for example, Vince, when I worked at WWE for 7 years, and Vince had great love for a lot of those old-timers like Freddie Blassie, Arnold Skoland, who had been another junior partner. Great love, like a father-to-son love. And I don't quite know if that was the nature of the relationship between Vince and Gorilla. I think it was a little more business. But, you know, they made Gorilla happy and things got smoothed over, so there wasn't really any outward conflict after, you know, things really started to take off in the mid-80s, like you said, the rock and wrestling years. And Gorilla realized, okay, look, I guess I made the right decision and this is the best possible outcome of the scenario that I found myself in.
You know, it's very interesting you mentioned Freddie Blassie, because I was thinking about that as I was reading this book, that Freddie Blassie had been off television for a long, long time. He lived a long life. I think 2003 is when he died, just 4 years outliving Gorilla by 4 years. But he was not a mainstay on television. He was not an announcer. He was not anything of that nature. But in later years, he was in these vignettes. He was brought out for special occasions. When his book came out, he was brought out on Monday Night Raw. Gorilla, who had been a far more integral part of the company as basically the voice of WWEF in the 80s and 90s, far more well-known at that point probably to the fans. When Gorilla died, I think it was a minute segment before the show started, and that was about it.
Yeah, and that speaks to, like I said, just the... And I don't want to minimize the relationship either, because I did hear from a lot of people that, you know, the McMahons were openly sobbing in the office on the day that Gorilla died. It wasn't like, you know, he didn't mean anything to them. But I got to see how close they were. Like, Freddie Blassie is a good example. Vince McMahon Sr. had known Freddie going back to the 60s as a wrestler. And when Freddie had to retire in the mid-70s, he brought him in full-time and made him a manager. And for fans of the WWF in that era, he's one of the mainstay wrestling managers from the mid-70s into the mid-80s before he finally had to retire from that. And he was another guy, you know, when Vince Sr. died on his deathbed, there was a list of people that he made sure that his son would have to take care of for life. Now, Gorilla was on that list, and so was Freddie. So Freddie also, had a job for life. Even when fans didn't see him on TV anymore, he had an office in Titan Tower. He was given work to do. But the difference between Gorilla and Freddie was, as you kind of indicated, Gorilla was a crucial part of the show backstage. He was very much plugged into the business. Freddie really wasn't. Freddie was just a very beloved friend of Vince's father, and it was more like, well, we have to find stuff for him to do, that kind of thing. I don't want to denigrate him. He was an amazing guy and a great talent, but it was more like, okay, we got to take care of Freddie. With Gorilla, Gorilla earned his keep a lot more. But I think in the end, like I said, it's another sign of how cherished and beloved someone like a Freddie Blassie was, probably more on a personal level than Gorilla Monsoon. That's a personality thing. That's Gorilla was, like I said, a rival, a competitor. He was a smart guy. He was a guy that knew his worth and wasn't just going to go along with everything blindly. And, that might have made him a thorn in the side from time to time.
Something else that's very interesting, whatever their relationship was in the early 80s when Vince Jr. gets a hold of the company, even if there was a rocky relationship and not as trusted a relationship, Gorilla Monsoon is the voice of War to Settle the Score. Gorilla Monsoon is the main commentator on the first 8 WrestleManias. He is the co-host on the number one cable show WWE had, Primetime Wrestling, until the early 90s. So even if they didn't have the greatest relationship, not only was Gorilla Monsoon kept on television, he was kept on television probably in the biggest way any broadcaster could be.
Yes, and that speaks to the trust. I mean, there really was trust there, and their business relationship was strong at that time. Now, a lot of people, again, may know if they know WWF wrestling before the expansion, Vince McMahon had been the sole voice of the WWF from about, he'd started commentating in the early 70s, and by the mid-70s, he had taken over all the weekly television as the announcer. He did the announcing from Madison Square Garden every month by himself with no partner, and I think by the time he took over, He didn't want to do that anymore. He didn't want to take himself off TV completely, but he wanted to be allowed a little more freedom to work backstage, especially on the big shows, like you were saying, the MTV specials, the pay-per-views. He was okay with Saturday night's main event. He liked being on network television on NBC, but he knew he needed help, and Gorilla Monsoon was the first person that he really trusted to take over part of those responsibilities. That's a big deal. Where he said to him, look, okay, we're going to split this. I'm going to have half these duties, and you're going to take the other half instead of me doing everything. And that was a big deal, and that really did speak to how much he trusted him and valued him, for sure.
Sort of unlike Freddie Blassie, as we talked about earlier, Gorilla, into the early 90s, is still on WrestleMania. He's still the main commentator. Now, here's a guy who's getting older at the time. He's well over 300 pounds. He's got the shady glasses. He certainly doesn't look like a kid. It's not the youth movement. What was it about Gorilla that allowed him to stay on television and so prominent longer than any of these other legends?
Well, that was part of it, was the deal that he had made, that you can't take me off television. Not that they didn't want him there, but, like, for example, when his health really was starting to get shaky, and they knew they couldn't really have him on TV doing the commentary every week anymore, and I don't think he wanted to anyway, they made him the WWF president. And that was a very calculated decision. It was, again, part of that deal. Okay, we got to keep Gino on TV. What could we have him do? And being WWF president was a lot less demanding because, he wasn't actually the president, of course. He was a television character. He was playing the president of the company. So he only had to show his face every now and then to make his proclamations. He would come out. He would go to the back. He didn't have to. It wasn't as much work. It was easier. And the other thing was Gorilla's health started to get a little shaky in the late 80s. He had diabetes from an early age, from his 30s. And he was a very big man. He had lost a lot of weight when he became a commentator, but he was still a big man. And he didn't take the greatest care of himself. He wanted to live life the way he wanted. So he smoked, he ate whatever he felt like eating, and that didn't help, obviously. And he started to have a, kind of a series of health issues. He had a heart attack at the beginning of 1988. He had to have part of his foot amputated in summer of 1990. And these things just started happening. And I think at that point, Vince started to not trust him as much. I don't mean on a personal level, but, you know, Vince is one of those guys. Vince is an alpha male, and he admires strengths, and you don't show weakness. And I think when Gorilla's health started to falter, Vince started to think, okay, I need to have a backup plan. I can't just rely on this guy anymore. And you start to see him bringing in other announcers that he's trying out, like Tony Schiavone, and later Jim Ross comes in and kind of gets Gorilla's spot. And, you know, that was part, because he wasn't that old. That's the thing that people sometimes forget. Like you said, it wasn't the youth movement. Gorilla had his first major heart attack in 1988. He was 50 years old. You know, I'm 50 now, and I certainly don't look like Gorilla Monsoon. So, it, you know, that was, his health was slipping, and it was aging him. And then by 1997, when he was WWF president, he had a major heart attack that really took him off television, and that's when fans stopped seeing him for a long time. And at that point, they really had to take him off TV. But believe it or not, even when he wasn't visually on television, they still found things for him to do. He was still doing, going into the TV studio, doing voiceovers for international syndication. You wouldn't see his face, but you'd hear his voice right up to the very end. They always found things for him to do.
Primetime Wrestling and Bobby Heenan. There are chapters in here, great chapters, about this. What was the relationship with Bobby Heenan and the place that Primetime Wrestling, the cable show, played in Gorilla's life?
They really and truly were the best of friends, and they absolutely loved each other. It's something that maybe, you know, when you're watching as a kid, you don't see that. You see two guys who hate each other and annoy each other, and they're constantly getting on each other's nerves. But when you watch it, I think, as an adult, and maybe you'll agree, you can see the love and friendship there. You could just feel it, that they're compadres, and they're almost laughing, and they're getting through it. They're having the time of their lives. And as far as the place that it had in Gorilla's heart, I mean, that was his favorite thing to do. Those years on Primetime Wrestling with Bobby, that was his favorite thing. And they, believe it or not, it wasn't long. They were on Primetime Wrestling together as the anchors from about April 1986 to about February 1991. That's not even 5 years. I mean, you know, that's the blink of an eye if you think about it. And those years are so fondly remembered today. And even as Gorilla's TV responsibilities were starting to, as he was being slightly phased out in that period because of his health, he didn't mind as long as he continued to get to do prime time with Bobby, because that was the thing he loved doing the most. And eventually they changed the format of the show, and Vince McMahon took over as the moderator, and it just wasn't the same anymore. But for those years, I mean, he was having the time of his life.
Gorilla had a son, Joey Morella, referee in the WWE. He's killed in a car accident July 4th, 1994. What did this do to Gorilla's life?
It destroyed him. There's no other way to put it. There's no question about it. And that also contributed to his waning enthusiasm and kind of fading away on television a little bit in those years. A lot of fans from that period certainly would have taken notice of that. Gorilla's just starting to kind of be phased out. His love for the business, his passion, his enthusiasm never really came back. He was thrown into this horrible depression that I don't think he ever really climbed out of. He lived another 5 years after Joey, and he was never the same. I think part of it was he felt guilt. You know, he had introduced Joey to this lifestyle and this business not wanting to and being reluctant. And this was like a worst nightmare come true, that Joey would succumb to the rigors of the road and the toll, the business would take its toll on him. And that was a very difficult weight for him to bear. And you talk to anybody that knew him in those years, and he never recovered from it. He wasn't the same person. He could turn it on when he needed to for TV, but he wasn't the same person in real life.
As the 90s go on, we see less and less of Gorilla, and certainly by 97, 98, we're not really seeing Gorilla on television at all. And then in March of 1999, WrestleMania 15, he's brought out as a surprise judge for the Brawl for All, and it's certainly not the Gorilla Monsoon anybody remembered. He's thin, kind of got a yellow tint to him. How did this all come to be?
What a lot of people don't realize is that he, when he disappeared from TV, he had not disappeared from the company. So he had his heart attack in the summer of 1997, and he was gone for about 6 months, recovering at home, in the hospital, whatever he needed to do. By the beginning of 98, even though no one was seeing him on TV, he was there. He was going to the TV tapings. He was going to local shows in his area. He wasn't traveling the country. You know, when they were at Madison Square Garden, he'd be there. When they're doing Monday Night Raw in New York, he'd be there. That kind of thing. If they're in Philly, he'll be there. But he was just backstage. He wanted to be a part of it. And he was coming into the TV studio in Connecticut to do voiceovers and things. But so he never really fully disappeared. But when WrestleMania 15 came around, you know, he had been at WrestleMania 14 the year before, but he just, which I think was Boston, he just wasn't put on television. At 15, I think the thing was everybody knew, including him, that his days were numbered. He was dying. His diabetes was really catching up with him, the heart attack. He was going into kidney failure. They wanted to put him on dialysis. He refused. So he knew that the end was coming, and I think they wanted, you know, at the time it wasn't acknowledged that way. They wanted to give him a chance to take a final bow and to say goodbye and make one last public appearance. That's what that was. WrestleMania was in Philadelphia that year, you know, like a 10-minute drive from his house, very easy. He just zipped over. He was one of the special judges for the Brawl for All match between Butterbean and Bart Gunn, and he got a big ovation. And from what I understand, as soon as the match was over, pretty much, home. He just, you know, got in the car and went back home to New Jersey. And I want to say that was March, so April, May. 7 months later, less than 6 months later, he was dead.
What were the last 6 or 7 months of his life like?
Not pleasant. Certainly not pleasant. It's not a pretty picture. It's sad in the book when it gets to that point, because he was suffering physically, for sure. And he was also, I think, suffering emotionally. He was very despondent. He made a choice, and when you think about this, I mean, I don't mean to over-exaggerate here, but, you know, it was kind of a form of slow-moving suicide. I mean, he had given up on life, and he said to multiple people, I just want to be with Joey. I don't want to be here anymore. You know, I love all of you, and I don't have to be here to love you. You know, I can't suffer like this anymore. This isn't a life. And he was very depressed. And, you know, the man was 62 when he died. And at the time of WrestleMania 15, he was 61. This is not an old man. He wasn't even collecting Social Security yet. And he had just given up. He refused to, you know, like I said, go on dialysis. And it was just a very sad time of him saying his goodbye to people and just waiting to die, essentially. It's not a pleasant. And, I mean, certainly it could have been a lot worse, but he made his choice and he chose to die.
You spoke about how people around the WWE office, the McMahons, were crying when word came that he had passed away. What was the funeral like? What was the reaction in the days after his death?
Well, the funeral was very well attended. Vince himself gave the eulogy. It was in Cinnamons in New Jersey near where Gorilla lived. And the interesting thing was you had a lot of people there from the TV studio who knew and loved him and saw him all the time. You had a lot of people from his generation of wrestlers were there, like Baron Mikel Cicluna, Johnny Rodz, Angelo Savoldi was there, Bugsy McGraw, Tony Garea, Jack Lanza, those kind of guys. And Jim Ross was there, Howard Finkel was there. The thing about it, though, the problem, well, what I think some people were taken aback by was that there were really no wrestlers from the current WWF roster there. And that hurt a little bit. That hurt the family a little bit. The only ones came from the roster were Savio Vega, who I'm not sure if he was even still on the roster anymore, but he knew Gorilla from Puerto Rico, and Miguel Perez Jr., who also, he was in Los Boricuas in WWF, but he knew Gorilla from the Puerto Rico days, because Gorilla wrestled a lot in Puerto Rico. But other than that, no one was there. Steve Austin and The Undertaker sent flowers. They were home. They weren't even on the road because they were both injured. And the fact that made it a little tougher to swallow was that week when he died, the WWE was touring locally. They were shows in the New York, Jersey area. So it's a little baffling. Everyone was in the area, but none of them came. And I don't know if that's partly because a lot of younger guys that didn't know him as well as the older generation did, because he had been really vital in the company for a good 5 or 6 years. I don't know, but I know that kind of hurt the family's feelings a little bit.
And Bobby Heenan, who's working for WCW at this time, of course he attends his friend's funeral, and this is very dramatic for Bobby.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I lost you.
Oh, no, I said Bobby attends this funeral, obviously, his dear friend, and this is a very tough moment for Bobby.
Yeah, Bobby, it's important to point out, Bobby Heenan had left the WWF by that point. He was working for WCW, the competition, you know. But their friendship, their relationship never ended because of that. And so Bobby made the trip up. WCW was doing shows down south that week, and he came up specifically for that. He was one of the main pallbearers. He was extremely emotional. People that were there talk about how broken up he was, you know, almost throwing himself on the casket and just not wanting to leave the graveside. And I talk about that in the book. And ironically, just as Gorilla was never the same after Joey died, I think Bobby wasn't the same after Gorilla died. And people didn't really grasp, the fans, I think, didn't really grasp how close they were. And if you notice when, you know, he had heartfelt tribute on Nitro that week, and when Bobby went in the Hall of Fame a few years later, a great, really funny speech, very funny and entertaining, and he doesn't mention Gorilla until the very end, and it wasn't because of forgetting about him. It was because he knew if he had mentioned him at the beginning, he wouldn't be able to get through it. Because he mentions him at the end saying, I wish Gorilla were here. And again, he gets very, very emotional, and the tone changes at the end because he never forgot Gorilla. Gorilla was they were each other's best friends that they had in their life.
What is the legacy of Gorilla Monsoon? It's kind of interesting because if you go to the WWE Network or you pull something up, chances are that the generation that's around now is pulling up something from the 80s or 90s, and they're seeing Gorilla as the announcer. Is that a good legacy for him to have?
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem with that legacy because he was so good at it, and he was so beloved at it, and he shaped way generations of fans and even future wrestlers look at wrestling and remember the wrestling from that time period. It was his exposure to a national and even international audience. And, you know, I think that I will say as much of a star that he was as a wrestler and an attraction, his contribution in a non-wrestling capacity are probably greater, you know, in terms of being in front of the camera and also the behind-the-scenes stuff. That's why even when we put a book together, I was very tempted to have a picture on the cover of him as the growling Manchurian guy. There are great pictures like that. I put that on the back, and I instead chose to have a picture on the front of him at his most recognizable as the TV commentator. And I think that's perfectly fine. I mean, that's quite a legacy to have.
You know, Brian, one of the things I love about this book, and when I first got it, I flipped back to it, the appendix, A Glossary of Gorilla-isms. You know, this made him very, very unique. Where did these things come from? You know, hatches.
right. The electricity's so thick you could cut it with a knife. The SRO lights went up early, that kind of thing. I had to include that glossary because I think people would have been disappointed if I didn't. It was just from very early on I knew, and I started collecting those phrases, terms. Talking to Valerie Gros' daughter, who was so helpful in the book, she told me, we were talking about that kind of stuff, that's just how he talked. That was not something he put on for those expressions, will you stop, give me a break, you know, that kind of thing. That was just his normal way of speaking. And he would just bring that to broadcast booth. All those anatomical references to obscure body parts and muscles and things. You know, I discovered that he had physical education in college, and his minor was in biology. And I'm pretty sure that he learned a lot of those anatomical terms in college, and he probably retained all that and then put it to good use later on in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, what did you learn? What was the most surprising fact you learned about Gorilla Monsoon putting this book together?
I think, really, the thing that's most interesting to me was what we talked about earlier, how rocky that transition was in the company, and learning that Gorilla had been the guy who had been earmarked to take it over, and what that whole transition of power was like. I think that's something that had never been talked about very much publicly, and it was something I very much wanted to get in there. Another thing I stressed in the book so much was his ethnicity. I'm looking myself. I grew up in a family, and learning that Gorilla was an American, which I already knew, and was very proud of it, he never really got to show it because he had a different gimmick. He was Gorilla Monsoon. He was presented as an Italian wrestler, and he always remained Gorilla Monsoon. In the book, I really wanted to underline that heritage and kind of reclaim how, in fact, the one of the early chapters is all about his family history. He's not even in the chapter. It's about his coming over from Italy, his grandparents, and finding a new life in America, and partly making it an immigrant story. So that was something I learned more about, and I really wanted to stress in the book.
You know, Brian, in our final minutes here, one of the most interesting things is the picture on the cover is a picture when Gorilla was in his announcing president days with the WWE. That look that he had, aside from when he was a wrestler, you know, the shady glasses, the slick-backed hair, he was a character, and I don't know. You know, they talk about a lot of other announcers in WWE history, Jim Ross amongst them. I don't know if anybody did it quite like Gorilla. His voice is on the soundtrack, especially with Hulk Hogan recently dying, on so much of that. And he has a unique way of doing it.
Yeah, even a Jim Ross, who a lot of people consider one of the of all time, and rightfully so, and some people consider the greatest of all time, Jim Ross speaks in glowing, admirable terms about Gorilla Monsoon every time he talks about him and how much he learned from him. Gorilla really was one of a kind, and I think he's trying to do something different. I call wrestling he was trying to establish trust with fans. He would call out things that wrestlers did wrong when he saw it. He wasn't afraid to do that. He was the voice of authority. And also, he learned a lot from the wrestling announcers who came before him to create that kind of larger-than-life persona on the microphone, and he just did it all so well.
Two quick questions in our final minutes here. Two people he had certainly associations with in the WWF, Jesse Ventura, who he was paired with for years, who went on to become governor, and Hulk Hogan, who he put over more than anybody else. What was his relationship with them like?
I think with Jesse, you know, they worked so well together. They got along. It was very professional. They were not the great friends that Gorilla and Bobby were. It was much more a professional relationship. You know, Jesse could be a rabble rouser sometimes and kind of a guy that was pushing for unions and things like that, and more power to him. But Gorilla was part of the office, so I think that that created a much more of a kind of professional-only type relationship. And as far as Hogan, you know, I don't know. I talked to Valerie after Hogan died and asking her that very question. And, again, I don't think they were the greatest of friends. I think there were a lot of things in Hogan's lifestyle in those days that were a part of the 80s lifestyle in general, if you catch my drift, that I don't think Gorilla was a great fan of, and those things bothered him. But he also understood that Hulk Hogan was the cash cow. and he was, you know, where the money was coming from, and you had to put him over. You had to make him look like $1 million. And he, you know, a rising tide raises all ships. And Gorilla understood the business well enough to know that you're not going to undercut the golden goose. So he was very smart in that way.
Was Gino Marella, Gorilla Monsoon, a good man, a friendly guy?
Yes. Yes, he absolutely was. He was a good and decent and beloved man. He could be tough when he needed to be. In that position, he had to be. He couldn't be a pushover or a softy, but those who knew him and were close to him, they talk about his generosity, his kindness, his giving nature, and his sensitivity. You know, his wife, Maureen, told me that he would cry when he got a Christmas card from somebody. You know, he was a very sensitive man, and he brought a lot of decency to everywhere he went. In fact, I opened the book with a spread of just glowing quotes from everybody on how much they loved him and respected him. You don't get that a lot in the wrestling business and have people genuinely mean it. But in the case of Gorilla, they did.
It is a fabulous, fabulous book. It really is. Over 400 pages, pictures, information, things you will pick up about a great guy. Irresistible Force, The Life and Times of Gorilla Monsoon. Number one right now, number one wrestling book on Amazon.com, as well it should be. Brian Solomon is the author. Brian, this is a tremendous, tremendous book and going to keep Gorilla alive for a long, long time. So thank you for doing it. And what a great book it is.
Oh, you're very welcome, Scott. And if that is what happens for Gorilla, if I can keep his name alive, then that's the whole goal that I'm going for.
Okay. Stay well, Brian.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Brian R. Solomon, it's a great book. Get it. Irresistible Force, The Life and Times of Gorilla Monsoon. Tell you the life of a great, great man. For this day, Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
World about Stith's depraved acts. Their courage in coming forward is what got us here today.